These are the stories that you need to know about today. I speak with Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. We exclusively discuss the peace talks, where they are, Epstein list, among other things. Trump says no. No, Russia did not violate the energy ceasefire. And that means if what Mr. Trump is saying is true, then Mr. Zelensky is not telling the truth. And the talks are back on between Russia and the United States. Where, how, who's involved? What are they saying? We got it. This is the Sanchez Effect. Busy day. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to welcome you to The Effect. Mr. Trump has just come out and said something, which is quite interesting, because it explains something which a lot of us were having a tough time trying to understand. Remember yesterday I did this story, and I said things are very difficult right now in Ukraine. Apparently their energy grid has collapsed, and people are suffering, and you got to feel bad for them. This is one of the snowiest and one of the coldest winters, both in Russia and in Ukraine, in a long time. So here's what they did. Both sides got together, apparently at Mr. Trump's urging, and both Mr. Putin and the Zelensky government decided, let's not hit each other militarily while these conditions are in effect. So both sides decided for 1 week there would be no firing, no attacks on energy grids, nothing that would make things more difficult for the people of Ukraine or for the people of Russia. But here's what happened. Apparently, during this time period, Ukraine's energy grid somewhat collapsed by itself, had nothing to do with Russian attacks. It's just that it was overloaded, and they had a problem with a pipeline that came in from Moldova. And as a result of that, the energy situation got very difficult there. Mr. Zelensky came out and blamed it on the Russians, essentially saying they had broken the ceasefire. It wasn't true. I spoke today, in fact, with the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov, who told me that he had heard that they had made that accusation, and it wasn't true. But, of course, that's a he said, she said, right? So where are we really? Here's where we are. Just a while ago, the president of the United States came out and said that what Zelensky was saying yesterday simply isn't true. Here's Mr. Trump.
It was Sunday to Sunday, and it opened up, and he hit him hard last night. No, he agreed. He kept his word on that. It's a lot. You know, 1 week is, we'll take anything because it's really, really cold over there. But it was on Sunday, and he went from Sunday to Sunday.
So it was Sunday to Sunday, and the Russians did not fire. Again, the Russians started on Monday, so they did respect the ceasefire. Zelensky said they didn't. Mr. Trump said, yes, they did, for what it's worth. By the way, what does that have to do with the negotiations now? Probably a lot, because it says where the United States are in trying to deal with both the Russians and the Ukrainians, who are meeting once again, you should know, in Abu Dhabi. Another conversation that I had today when I was talking to the foreign minister about how these negotiations are going right now. These are important talks, as you might imagine. As you can see right here, the regular players are gathered once again. Steve Witkoff and Mr. Jared Kushner. The Ukrainian team is there. Mr. Zelensky's office is represented. Members of the Ukrainian team are also there. Kirill's there, the representative from Russia to the United States, who we've introduced you to on several occasions. So there you see a lot of these players who are involved in these discussions. The question is, how close are we? Where are we, right? I wanted to broach this subject today while I was talking to Mr. Lavrov at the ministry. And he not only tells me an explanation of more or less where they are, and I sensed a tone that is somewhat positive, and I don't want to overstate this, but I sensed a somewhat positive tone from him. But he also told me that they already thought they had a deal in Alaska. And then all of a sudden the Europeans got involved and the deal was gone. But he says again, and stress this, that the Russians are ready to do a deal right away as long as their security concerns are also met. Here's Mr. Lavrov.
I don't know what our delegation in Abu Dhabi will be offered. I had a conversation with them yesterday.
What did they say?
Regarding this idea security guarantees that Mark Rutte talked about yesterday in the Rada in Kyiv. And if this is what the Ukrainians went to Abu Dhabi with, well, I think this is just another another reason to believe that Zelensky needs no peace, that any peace will mean an end to his political career, probably not only his political career. After talking with Rutte, Zelensky said he's willing to take compromises, but Russia also has to be willing to make compromises. And this is, well, blatant statement, I think. But I think conscience and Zelensky don't go together well. And he thinks about nothing, I think, except his own survival. When we came to Anchorage and when two presidents sat down with their teams, we said that this hadn't been an easy move for us, but we're willing. We conceded to certain initiatives from the U.S. We took compromises. We basically accepted their propositions. And then we waited for a long time for our American counterparts to announce that, yes, the agreement has been made. We have this and this and this. They said, we inherited Ukraine from Biden, basically. Mm-hmm. Who was absolutely anti-Russian in his stance. So Ukraine popped up on the foreground, on the international agenda, and this has to be settled, and we will do that, they said. And at the same time, they understood our position. And once we are done with Ukraine, then there will be lots of mutually beneficial stuff going on for the well-being of our two nations here and there. But Ukraine is still there. The issue is still there on the table. It gets new dimensions that look more and more like new covenants and demands to Russia. But still, the conversation is going on. We supported the United States propositions, and Europe immediately rushed to Washington to tweak and adjust the initiative that had already been approved by President Putin. And they're still tampering with it. They're still trying to tweak it. President Putin said that we are willing to see a diplomatic solution to that. We have never changed our terms, unlike many other participants of this political process. They have been, well, moving the goalpost many times.
He was so gracious in being able to give me as much time as he did. In fact, most of the people there, it was my first time visiting the ministry. And it's interesting because we happened to be visiting and doing that interview just ahead of what is Diplomatic Workers' Day at the ministry. So it was an important day today at the Russian ministry, not just for the officials, but for so many of the people who work there. By the way, I also had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Lavrov about something else. And because the news of the day all over the world, I mean, you can't open up a newspaper or watch a newscast without people talking about Epstein. And it's not just about Epstein anymore. It's about all these people who this latest batch of files seems to indicate were involved with Epstein. Who are these people? What kind of sick human beings would do some of the things? And I know not everything here has been substantiated. It's kind of troubling that nobody has been even investigated, by the way. But still, who are these people? And it makes one wonder. If some of the same people who are now being named in this list that came out of the Epstein files are also some of the same people who've had such a negative effect on the global situation, the geopolitical situation around the world, whether you're talking about Gaza or whether you're talking about Ukraine or whether you're talking about any type of situation. And I asked Mr. Lavrov about this very thing, and here's his response. The type of people we're learning now who were involved in this horrible Epstein thing, these people who were deceitful,
somewhat decrepit. Is this the same kind of person who have led to what happened in Ukraine, to the coup in Ukraine, to the deceit in Ukraine? Would you say that that's the same kind of person? Or maybe even some of the exact people?
I think
regarding the specific persons, specific personalities, we can't probably make generalizations like that, but the fact, what we call the deep state, what is known as the hidden funds or closed groups, and they are said to be able to decide the fates of the world. Well, I don't quite believe in that, because people who are elected presidents or prime ministers, they have enough leverage to pursue their own course. And if they all pursue a course that is all about deceiving, that is all about being unable to feel shame or to blush for openly lying to their partners, well, that's a fact. There are plenty of such people there, and right now I think this mentality is showing very visibly on the European arena. And they haven't been making any conclusions, obviously. They haven't taken any lessons.
By the way, I just returned from the ministry, and as a result, I should tell you that we're now putting together the full interview, and that full interview is going to air tomorrow, right here, on The Sanchez Effect. Look for it. All right, here we go. As we continue, and just after a short break, I'm going to be joined by Tyler Nixon. He's a popular talk show host in the United States, served in the U.S. Army. He was in Germany, staff assistant to former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, worked on the presidential transition team for Presidents Bush and for Ron Paul when he ran for president. All this coming up with Tyler Nixon when we come back. Don't go away. Tyler Nixon, he's good enough to join us. He's a U.S. Army infantry veteran. He's also a lawyer, by the way, and a very dapper guy who's worked as a talk show host, constitutional advocate. You heard a little while ago all the presidents he worked for. I think he worked for every president except the one named after him, or is he named after the president? Nixon, that is. Mr. Nixon, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Rick, it's an honor to be with you, and I'm surprised you didn't mention that I'm counsel to Roger Stone, which is certainly enough of a Nixon connection, I guess.
The Roger Stone?
The Roger Stone, yes.
I'm kidding.
Is there any other?
Would you do me a favor, after we're done talking, if you approve of me, of course, as an anchor or as a news presenter or whatever they call us these days, let Mr. Stone know that I would welcome him here to talk to me as well.
I certainly will. Maybe we can arrange that.
That'll be great. So let's get started, because I want to hear what you have to say. Maybe we start there, this latest thing with Mr. Trump. I think what Mr. Trump is doing is showing that he can be a better arbiter of this situation between Ukraine and Russia than certainly his predecessors. Do you agree?
Well, certainly, because, I mean, he obviously didn't go all in on either side. And has wanted to keep sort of an open prospect, you know, open hand in the situation.
Yeah.
And you know, let's face it. I mean, this is a mess. This is the creation of the Obama administration and a lot of ulterior motives at play there. Certainly the Bidens, who I grew up with and knew very well from my roots in Delaware, and you know, President Trump, I think is someone who could bring a resolution that wouldn't be on, you know, particularly lopsided. And, you know, he made that clear through the campaign. He was not supporting Ukraine to the level that the prior administration did, but certainly Biden did. And he's certainly not interested in being anti-Russian per se. I mean, and let's face it, the Democrat Party has taken on this mantle of just Russophobic paranoia to a dangerous degree. And irrational, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. By the way, you just mentioned that you grew up with the Bidens. What was that like?
How much time you got, mister? No.
I
went to school. I grew up in Wilmington, Delaware. And so we went to church with the Bidens every Sunday. I knew Bo and Hunt from grade school, as well as went to high school with both of them. I was a grade behind Hunt, two grades behind Bo. Socialized with them, in the years that followed. Not really like within their inner circle by any stretch, but it was very interesting, very wild. A lot of insights. Certainly Hunter's activities. There was a lot of foreshadowing, let's just say, in the earlier years of what was to come. But yeah,
well, I feel bad for him. I mean, he's a disaster of a human being. He's a drug addict. Every kind of decrepit thing that a human being can do. And I'm not saying this to judge him. I'm just saying what we know, what he's copped to, what his own father has said about him is he really went through a spell where he was just a pretty decrepit human being doing some really horrible things, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that he was sort of the wild child or I think he knew that he was number two. He was not going to be the golden child. Bo was the heir to the throne. Bo was the, super squeaky clean politician, going to follow in dad's footsteps, maybe even be president someday. And Hunter was always in that shadow, number two. And I think he knew that. And he certainly said to me a number of times in confidence that he didn't like being not having a choice as to being anonymous or not. He was thrust into this spotlight from a very young age and didn't really take to that. And I think, he sort of and given his father's drug warrior credentials, I think there was very much a sense of rebellion against, his innate revulsion with the situation he was put in and locked into that. Because of the nature of the beast. I mean, it's, the Biden brand, the Biden family, some call the Biden crime family. And when Bo died, I think he just went completely off the rails. I mean, more so than ever.
How do you compare that to some of these? Because some of the things that I've read that he did were just absolutely crazy. And some of the things that I'm reading that some of these people did with Epstein, just sick, horrible, crazy. I mean, I'm imperfect. I'm Catholic and, you know, we're all imperfect in the eyes of God.
We're all sinners, yeah,
but,
for sure.
But you know what I mean? I mean, how do these people get to that level? I think maybe it has to do with having too much power and too much money, no?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think in his case, he was impugned from a very young age. I mean, there was nothing he could do that was going to get him, seriously in serious trouble.
Yeah.
Short of, murdering someone or some kind of a serious injury to somebody, any of these sort of vices that he indulged were always going to be covered up. He was always going to be shielded by, sadly, by law enforcement in Delaware or in later years, the Secret Service and his father's general sort of umbrella of protection. And that does not make for someone who has any sort of self-constraint or self-discipline. I mean, this is, again, from a very young age. I mean, he also, his mother, natural mother tragically was killed right after Biden was elected to the Senate in 72. So, he was really, the sister Valerie and, the family helped to raise them, but, was an absentee father without a constant mother presence, I think, contributed to that. I don't want to psychoanalyze, but I will say this. Look, the Epstein stuff with the, I don't want to mention it, but I mean, we know what we're talking about here. The underage, the pedophilic, predatory nature of it.
They rape little girls.
I would never put Hunter.
They rape girls. That's what they did.
Yeah, rape. I mean, I would never put Hunter in that category. I mean, okay. Look, Hunter's done a lot of sleazy things. I think, he's been exploitive, but he's never, I don't think he's never gone down that. I mean, it's always been with adults, with, situations that were not coerced on the other end. I mean, he might have been paying for it in some ways, and there might have been a lot of drug transaction, things like that, but it was never in that realm of degeneracy and criminality.
Well, the media is having a field day with this, and I understand it, squirrel, right? I mean, look at the shiny object. It's an obvious story, and it's the kind of story that makes headline writers want to go to work a little bit early on days like this. And I understand all that. But, you know, it's funny how they're talking about all these men that did these horrible things, most of it because a lot of these men are famous. But at the same time, none of these men have been prosecuted. Not a single one has even been investigated. You know, what the hell does that tell you about the country we live in, you and I, the United States of America?
It's a sad statement. It's absolutely the two tiers of justice, as Roger has come to become fond of citing.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the elites are impune, just as I mentioned, Hunter Biden was and has been. And, you know, to me, like, obviously, the crimes involving children or underage, you know, the predatory stuff, I mean, is really sick and perverse. But frankly, you know, the most consequential of the crimes are things that we're seeing now involving, for example, the relationship between Epstein and Bill Gates and the, you know, sort of foreshadowing of investing and profiting from vaccines and a pandemic situation. Mm. I mean, Gates is really Bill Gates. Oof, he is really coming up. This is really pulling as if people didn't know already. I mean, the guy's sort of just drips evil. But yeah. I mean, really, now we're having
remove
confirmation
the veil.
Of his.
You're trying to say, like, they've removed the veil from him, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's like it was suspected. It was alluded. It's confirmed. It's right there in his own, you know, his own documents.
And by the way, we should be fair because journalistically responsible thing to say is that he has not been found guilty. And there is a possibility.
Allegedly.
There is a possibility that Mr. Epstein was blackmailing him by reporting these things or saying these things or releasing this stuff about him to hurt him or to blackmail him. So that's also out there.
Well, I mean, I was reviewing an agreement or some sort of a legal document in which Bill Gates personally selects and names Epstein as the representative of Bill Gates's primary science advisor, whose name escapes me at the moment, in some sort of transaction or something that was going on. So, I mean, you know, he had, as one post noted, Gates has access to every law firm, every potential representative he could choose in the world as a fiduciary or as a representative, and he chose Jeffrey Epstein in this. So, you know, he was thick as thieves with this guy. And there's no two ways about it. And look, if Bill Gates wants to sue me over it, I mean, allegedly, or, you know, I think Gates has done enough. Gates's publicly visible actions are enough, frankly, to question what this guy's about.
And Mr. Clinton, Mr. Trump, the royals in England, member of the Labour Party, I mean, they all looked like they were somehow doing something with people who could be our daughters. And it ain't right. And, you know, I'm not sure what it says about America right now, or maybe the world, because it's not just America, is it? There's all kinds of people like that. Is this something that's just been going on since millennia? Is this just something where when you get powerful and you get rich, you get bored and you do stupid crap like this?
Oh, I think it's the old Lord Acton maxim that, you know, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think, once these people achieve a certain, once you have everything at your disposal, there's nothing that can stop you from buying, obtaining what you want. I think people's true character comes out. And unfortunately, I've often said, show me a billionaire, I'll show you a greedy bastard. Mm. I think people who would accumulate that level of wealth and what's required to get it are already challenged in terms of their essential character. Unfortunately, when you have those resources at your disposal and there's people like Jeffrey Epstein running around that are more than willing to take advantage of that and to sort of, slide between the pillars of power and money. And do all the dirty work and make these dirty connections happen. It just makes it easier. And it's a sad statement, but I think the essential core of the human being is nothing like this. I mean, this is just really, they talk about the elites. They're elite in the sense, many of them, in the sense of their being frankly, degenerate compared to the average human who has a conscience and who has a moral sense.
And that's what happens when apparently you get to that level where you have that much money, that much power. You start taking for granted what other people's needs and other people's feelings are because they're little people. They don't seem to matter.
Everything's an object. Everything's for sale. Everything is objectified. It really is a dangerous level of power.
These same people, by the way, who did that and repeatedly, in not all cases, but many, kept going back and back to Jeffrey Epstein, are the same people who bribe our politicians, own our politicians, and feel like they're, in that sense as well, more deserving than most of us. They get to pay fewer taxes. They get to get their interests served by the people that we put in Congress. That's another part of the problem that we have in our country right now. And those politicians don't think of the little guy either. They think of only the big guys who are taking care of them.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, I think that's really the story that behind the story that's the main. I mean, they're sort of, you know, burying the lead. I mean, yes, there are a lot of these crimes that are being laid out. And I would say that really, I mean, where the focus needs to be is on Epstein's communications, because statements from alleged, you know, victims of, say, Donald Trump. I mean, these are the kinds of things that could be inserted into that record. And have no verifiability. I mean, but Epstein's own communications and who he communicated with and what they were communicating, that's not something that could be, you know, faked per se, and would have some level of verifiability. But the story behind the story is not, I mean, the story being, you know, obviously all these sort of degenerate crimes, but the fact of what it was for. And what it was for was the blackmailing of and the extortion of people of influence and power, particularly in government, and who is behind that, and what is their objective, and you know, are we basically being governed by a government that is rife with people who are being, you know, are puppets basically because of their own predilections and peccadilloes are doing the bidding of a foreign power.
Yeah, a foreign power.
Whether that by the way, and if they can't buy them off, then they just extort them, and that's the real story that needs to be tackled.
The average member of both the Senate and Congress gets over $120,000 from Israel, and it's interesting to note that it certainly looks like. By the way, 98% of them have in some form or another taken money from Israel. And everything I've been reading within the last week tells me that Jeffrey Epstein has very, very ardent ties to Israel and seemed to have been very well connected to the Mossad. Is there anything out there that would make me full of crap for saying that? Because I haven't seen it.
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, it seems to me like that's exactly what he was, you know, the whole Epstein Island, all that thing seems to me like an operation. He was certainly, I've mentioned a phone call with him, with Ehud Barak, who was the head of the Israeli military.
So did I.
You know, also the nation's leader for a long time. And this is 2013. He's becoming his, helping him transition into private life and to basically cash in on his connections, on his, you know, the debts owed to him for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen Israel come out and, openly refute this or repudiate this. And what bothers me, especially, I think that should bother everyone is the way, let's face it. I mean, this is, they're very chauvinistic about their Jewishness in these. I mean, you know, the references to the goy, to the goyim are shocking. I mean, it's like the rest of the world. I mean, this level of chauvinism, I do not think is a rarity or is exclusive to Epstein and say financiers that he deals with.
But it's horrible.
I think
because,
unfortunately, like a Netanyahu.
Then we should say this just in case people get the wrong impression, because I know you're not saying this, but the Jewish people are a wonderful, wonderful people with great interests who've served our planet very well. And the people who are being harmed the most right now are them. Not just by what Epstein has done, but also by, in many ways, what the Netanyahu government has done. My opinion. You don't have to share it.
I agree exactly as I said about the so-called elites are the, you know, the 1%. They are a blight on the human race and sort of, you know, reflect the worst, the worst impulses. So I think, you know, the same thing. I mean, I think the Jewish people and Israelis are, I mean, I think they're, well, Jewish people, let's just say, are very poorly depicted and by the people who are at the, you know, at the top of this, this sort of, money heap, power heap, whatever have you, the Epsteins of the world. And it's a shame because, I mean, it really does. I mean, you know, it sparks what you, well, I'm not gonna say anti-Jewishness because anti-Semitism, I think is a, misnomer or a sort of a trope that's overused. But no, I mean, it's not helpful to the cause of people of, you know, this diaspora around the world to have people like Epstein speaking like this, you know, and speaking of the rest of humanity as cattle.
I get your point that they're basically, they're not serving the good community that the Jewish community around the world is well by representing them this way. And that's what I get from a lot of my friends as well. Hey, let's switch to the U.S. in general, politically and maybe economically. I'm starting to get a sense that things are backsliding economically in the United States. Many of the reports I'm reading seem to indicate that because specifically of this $38 trillion debt, it's going to be hard for the United States to reinvigorate its currency, the dollar around the world, for example, its banking system. All of the things that the world depended on are now not going to be so, or are not so dependable because of what's going on. What is your sense of this, and how is it being handled by either party?
I mean, the chickens are coming home to roost, and it's a very sad, it's a very sad situation because the American people, frankly, are did not choose this. I mean, and you look at the amount of fraud, you look at the amount of profligacy in terms of defense spending and the corporate profiteering on the backs of American taxpayers while running this massive debt. It's unconscionable. It's frankly, it's immoral. And I think, unfortunately, you know, it's getting to the point where, I mean, we've known this is, I mean, you cannot constantly live on a credit card that's maxed out and extended and maxed out and extended and do this repeatedly and expect your currency to remain stable. I mean, it's already been devalued by untold proportions over the last century. And then you've got, you know, interest rates, you know, people are being squeezed from every direction. You can't have the entire working population of a country living, you know, hand to mouth, paycheck, you know, to paycheck, and expect to have a vigorous and vibrant and robust economy that isn't really just built for, again, the elites at the top and, you know, the profiteers and the people who are willing to get and grab whatever they can. And the fact of, like, for example, I mean, I was struck by this, the healthcare fraud that's going on, for example, with Somalis in Minnesota. But, you know, it interested me that the Democrats were so big on healthcare reform and, you know, and enacting all these sort of, you know, they wanted to do universal healthcare and all this. And yet this it turns out that healthcare in California, they're finding, is one of the absolute single most.
Oh, it's a disaster.
Prolific sources of fraud where, I mean, they've got hospices everywhere. I mean, it's like 18% of the United States spending, you know, or subsidization is going to California in one area. And it's sad because I think they've exploited this, this issue that people's need, you know, desire to have health security, let's just say, and used it to profiteer and to just rape the American people and rape the treasury. And now we're stuck again with close to $40 trillion. I mean, this is just inconceivable. I don't know what the end game is going to be. I would hate to see our country just devolve into sort of a third world situation, but it doesn't look good. But I think the American people do have the wherewithal and the ability ultimately to overcome it.
And maybe we
should
finish
our politicians.
And maybe we should finish up where we started, because it's not just the Ukraine war. It's not just Israel. It's also Iraq. It's also Afghanistan. It's also Syria. It's also Libya. I can go on and on, going all the way back to Vietnam. We keep getting into these huge, creating these global conflagrations these wars that not a single person in the United States benefits from. Take Ukraine, for example. If indeed we've gone as far as $300 billion that we have sent to Ukraine, how has that improved the life of one single person in the United States, except the guy who works at a plant where they make bombs and stuff and bullets? Where? Right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's absolutely, it's plunder. It's plunder by war. And it's just, it's tragic, really, because of the, you know, I mean, of all the things to absolutely just bleed the American treasury for, in addition to the blood spilt by Americans overseas, I mean, and to what end? And this is where I think, you know, there's going to be, I mean, there's talk of civil war brewing, and there were already, some people say we're already in a soft civil war in the United States.
Marjorie Taylor Greene said that last week, as a matter of fact. We covered it.
Yeah, she did. And I think, you know, here's the thing is, I mean, again, I would rather see the country broken up than go down as some sort of kleptocracy. That's just the global villain and you know, meddler in all things global, projecting our force to meddle with foreign in the affairs of foreign countries and bombing, you know, foreign peoples for what, you know, for what, for totally contrived objectives that, you know, a total front, basically, you know, wars for oil posed as, oh, we're going to democratize the world. I mean, this is, you know, it's very sad because our intelligence services have done the American people the greatest disservice possible, which is we are going to be held to account for their sins.
Would you consider yourself a conservative, a Republican? I hate labels, too, I know, but just to get a sense of kind of where you are, what you're evolving into. Where are you now?
I mean, honestly... In my sort of heart of hearts, I'm an anarchist. And when I say anarchist, meaning I reject the notion of this inherent authority that lords itself over people, you know, that can basically get together and rule people versus having a self-governing people. But yeah. I'm a Republican, small R Republican, in the sense I believe in Republican form of government. I'm a libertarian in the sense that I believe in liberty. I'm certainly conservative in the sense that I do not believe in these, the left's, to use that term, the left, I mean, it's sort of it's a flat term, but I don't believe in the Marxian project, the progressive project of remaking man. I don't believe that man is perfectible and that, you know, human nature will ever change.
Do you get a sense, final question, I'm going to let you answer this, Tommy. Do you get a sense that Americans are seeing things more as you just described them, that we're starting to see both left and right, you know, the Tucker Carlsons of the world and the Chuck Huggers of the world, both looking at this thing and saying, you know what, we've got a lot more in common than we have to disagree with. Do you see that?
Absolutely. I absolutely have felt that.
So do I.
I think that's been brewing for since Ron Paul, frankly, stepped into the, you mentioned Ron Paul, since he stepped onto the scene. And, you know, you would find a Dennis Kucinich and a Ron Paul, you know, from purportedly different ends of the spectrum agreeing with each other.
Yep.
And I think, look, what it is the information age has come to roost. Now, it can be either used as a control grid to corral humanity and to surveil and, you know, to dictate a totalitarian state over us, or it can be used to empower us. And the question is, what, you know, which do we choose? Will we stand for being ruled by a tiny group of elites? And I think, you know, human nature is such that, no, they're not going to stand for it. And I think people are feeling more and more empowered. And I'm ultimately a Reagan-level optimist. I cannot just view a dismal future that and just consign us to the abyss.
I'll tell you what, good talk. I really enjoyed this. I think you give us all hope for, I think, the direction that most of us know we need to go in. Unfortunately, there are too many people, the elites, as we like to say, not just in the United States, by the way, it's not just our country. I see this around the world. I especially see it in certain countries in Europe these days. And
very
it's troubling.
True. Very true. It's all coming to a head.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. And I hope it gets redirected. You have been a delight to talk to. Thank you so much. By the way, if somebody wants to get a hold of you, what do they do?
I think Real Tyler Nixon on Twitter is probably the best place to find my my musings and rantings and ramblings.
We'll look for this interview there. We'll be posting it as well. Thank you, Tyler. You're a good man.
Honored to be with you, Rick. Thank you.
All right. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. And by the way, it's important to note that we're going to be playing my interview with Mr. Lavrov tomorrow as the main event in this newscast. So I literally had just gotten back to the studio here when we were able to, and thanks to the folks at the ministry, say that we were able to release some of those, some of the technology, some of the interviews that we did. So we were able to show you a couple of clips, but you'll see the entire thing tomorrow. And once again, thanks to Mr. Lavrov for being so gracious with his time. I think we went a little bit over our allotted time, so for what it's worth. This is Journalistically Speaking. As I mentioned a little while ago, you can also find me on not just on YouTube, but also on X and BitChute as well, coming to a store near you. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for letting us into your home. We'll be looking for you next time.